the business model of these companies really only works if we're talking Uber, Lyft, or any of these delivery companies.
If they can pay their workers nothing.
Yeah.
Numbers don't lie. Right. Black voters, once again, have saved this party, this candidate, and in so doing, literally have saved this country from another 4 years of death and destruction.
Our question today comes from JG, a member of the Local 271. JG asks, why don't we see our union reps on the job site more? I can't remember the last time I saw one come out to check on us.
A lot of the folks who lost their places, they lived in trailer parks or low-income housing between, basically Ashland and over just North Phoenix is where the most of the devastation took place. A lot of these people were hardworking, ordinary people, and this has really hurt a segment of our community. These weren't millionaires who owned banks who lost their houses.
My name is Marco Camacho. I teach at Whittier Elementary. I'm a special education teacher. The reason why we're marching is for our students.
So now I'm gonna stand on the strength of those shoulders of those who stand up and never back down. These hands have the strength to move.
Bombastic slapstick is our weapon of choice. We always draw a crowd. We're red and hot and proud. Silent no, hell allowed. The San Francisco Mime Troupe.
Wow, have we got a show for you this week. Labor Radio examines the unprecedented corporate misinformation campaign that led California voters to approve the landmark anti-worker ballot measure, Proposition 22. Then, on Building Bridges, Black Voters Matter Fund co-founder Cliff Albright on how to increase power in our communities. Grit Northwest is a Carpenters Union podcast and one of the newest members of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. This week, they answer the question, dude, where's our reps? In the wake of the horrific devastation of the Alameda fire, the Brain Labor Report visits with contractor Anthony Kurtz about plans to clean up and rebuild with an emphasis on local jobs in Oregon's Rogue Valley. And CTU Speaks looks back at the 2019 Chicago teachers' strike, not just all that the teachers won, but all that they have yet to realize. We wrap up with two shows that feature inspiring music this week. Activate Live interviewed the producer and director of Stand, the movie musical that premieres December 1st in 46 states across the country. And the San Francisco Mime Troupe recently wrapped up their great radio drama, Tales of the Resistance. Will the resistance become a revolution, or will the fascist corporate overlords maintain their control over the workers? I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on today's Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, bringing you working people's voices with a selection of highlights from the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Here's the show.
Raising our voice, serious comedy, our weapon of choice. We always draw a crowd. Yeah! We're red and hot and proud. Yeah! Silent no, hell allowed.
Yeah!
San Francisco Mime.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Just before we start the show here, I'd like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of this show each month. Be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org. In this episode, we are going to be discussing the success of Proposition 22 in the state of California. Just to give a quick breakdown of what Prop 22 is so that you understand what we're going to be discussing, it was officially referred to, or it's officially named, the App-Based Drivers as Contractors and Labor Policies Initiative. And the goal, the stated goal of the initiative, was to define app-based transportation, ride shares, and delivery drivers as independent contractors, and to adopt labor and wage policies specific to app-based drivers and companies. It basically permanently exempts gig economy companies from ever having to classify their contracted workers as employees, which means that effectively those workers are not going to be and will never be covered by labor law requirements relating to healthcare, unemployment insurance, safe working conditions, and other benefits, potentially including workers' compensation such as death benefits. And included in Prop 22's fine print is a requirement that the measure cannot be modified with less than 7/8 of the state's legislature's approval, all but ensuring it cannot be
overturned. Yeah, it's killer.
Yeah.
Killer.
Yeah, so this is basically enshrined in California law. That's a huge blow to workers, and specifically gig economy workers, which is a growing sector of the economy, of the workforce, especially now with the pandemic raging on and us heading into further lockdowns and everything. That is one of the fastest growing sectors of the workforce. And so this is a huge blow to the rights of workers and to the future ability to make a living doing this and to be safe and healthy doing that.
I think in addition to the money, there's also some aspects in play here of just kind of general confusion around the terms.
Correct.
And I think a lot of the times when someone thinks of a contractor, they think of someone as successful, having multiple clients, all of this thing. But I think it's in a lot of cases for a gig worker, that kind of description doesn't always necessarily fit.
Absolutely.
And I think this might be a good place to talk about a little bit about like kind of what are seen as like the benefits and maybe the negatives of the gig economy.
Right.
So traditionally when you talk to someone about the gig economy, the kind of primary benefits that they talk about, you know, for the individual worker is flexibility, independence, and then kind of like variety of tasks. I think in this case in particular, it maybe doesn't apply as much. I mean, I guess you could drop off food in addition to people.
Right.
But really, you're kind of carrying some sort of cargo.
Yeah.
And I think in the majority of circumstances, and perhaps we'll touch on this later, those advantages aren't typically advantageous.
Yeah.
Most people aren't using this as like a side thing to make more money because, as we'll get into in the disadvantages, the pay is usually quite bad.
Exactly.
So usually this is in a stable of other things that they're doing in terms of low wage activities in order to equal one real kind of more normal looking 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, piecing a bunch of small gigs together in order to equate one full-time income. Yeah.
And I think the flexibility, which you see hammered on a lot, is a really interesting way to look at it because really the only reason the flexibility helps a gig worker is so that they can also find more side hustles to then be flexible with,
exactly.
Right? Like a typical person is looking for a job to try to make income, have a family, do all these types of things. And that's stable. And the flexibility in a lot of cases for, you know, a gig worker is actually going to lead to more stress and different things.
Yeah, because no one wants 10 jobs. Like, that's not anyone's ideal of what they're doing. The reality is that a growing segment of the people that do that work are actually doing it as their full-time employment.
Yeah.
One of the sort of misinformation narratives that they pushed was that 80% of the drivers work less than 20 hours a week. Which is can be a bit, like, that's the thing they push, but it can be a bit misleading because it ignores the fact that these platforms rely almost entirely then on the 20% of the workforce that works full time and handles 80% of the actual gigs.
Mm-hmm.
What should be focused on here are that 20% or in that growing percentage of the workforce that does do it full time and that is being completely exploited.
Yeah, and they're the ones kind of facing the full brunt of the disadvantages of gig work, which are mostly around how poor the pay can be. How little benefits, well, no benefits there are.
Right.
And then especially on top of that, you know, because they're not legally classified as employees, employers don't have to withhold income tax or Social Security from their paychecks.
Right.
So a lot of people who don't understand exactly what's going on can get really confused. And in addition to that, a lot of people aren't taking into account, you know, as a gig worker, especially owning a car and having a car, you know, a lot of the times they're not taking into account future repair or depreciation of a vehicle because essentially they're acting as their own business.
Right.
Even though to them it's not always, you know, visible up front that that's what they're doing. But it's especially funny to me when essentially what Uber and Lyft are saying is that the government needs to help us because our business model doesn't work.
Exactly.
And so what's happening here is kind of neo-capitalism, which is basically businesses who have no you know, way to profitability, who are being propped up by the government in order to, like, to protect jobs. Or in this case, I think people like their Ubers and they want to be able to take Ubers and they remember how bad taxis were, right? And things of that nature. So I just think it's a very interesting scenario to be caught in that it's essentially a cry for help for a business model that, you know, grew really quickly, but then doesn't really have a path forward to profitability.
Exactly. The business model of these companies really only works
if they can pay their workers nothing.
Yeah, so if you can fully automate the driving of a car or the delivering of food, and until that is possible, these companies are not going to be profitable. And so exactly like Elliot just said, they have figured out a way by rigging the system, by using their, throwing their money around in a post-Citizens United world, to essentially write laws that subsidize them, that essentially allow them to continue being in a viable business model, despite the fact that the market itself has deemed them unviable.
Mm-hmm.
With that, we are going to wrap up the show. Thank you so much for listening to Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
We will be talking to you soon.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. First up, Georgia on my mind and changing the landscape for Black Power with Cliff Albright, co-founder and executive director of Black Voters Matter Fund, writer and radio talk show host.
My first question is, a lot of the liberal cable media, who is most definitely partisan to the Democrats, have suggested that the Latinx vote did not come through as they expected for the Democrats. And similarly, that 20% of Black men supported Trump. So your thoughts on the diminishing of the significance of the Black and brown votes that I believe clearly took Biden to victory over the Trump Republican juggernaut?
Well, it's really a double-sided attack, right? On the one hand, you've got people that are trying to point out that lack of support for Joe Biden. And then on the other hand, what they're also doing that takes it even deeper is what they then say is that even in terms of the congressional races and the Senate races, what they're really doing is they're blaming Black and brown issues, defund the police or, you know, progressive calls for health care or whatever it may be, but they're really blaming Black and brown progressive issues. They may say the progressive part of the party, but when they say that, they're really talking about Black and brown folks. What they're saying is, not only did we not support Joe Biden enough, by the way, it's because of you all that we lost some of these seats. Both of those are wrong and, in fact, dangerous, because at the end of the day, it is Black and brown voters that put Joe Biden over the top. Regardless of what you may say, now there's a debate to be had about Florida, and there's some discussions that we got to have about some segments of the Latinx population in Florida. We've known for some time now that Cuban Americans, a certain political perspective that can sometimes be overly conservative and problematic. There's a discussion that needs to be had about Florida and about the diversity of the Latinx vote. But this is what we know. It's brown folks in Arizona, along with our indigenous brothers and sisters that I don't want to leave out, right? But it's brown folks, indigenous folks in places like Arizona and then Nevada that took Joe Biden over the top. It is without a doubt Black voters in places like Detroit that took him over the top in Michigan. And not even just Detroit. Look at Kalamazoo. Look at Flint. Look at some of the other cities in Michigan that don't get enough attention. Black voters that helped take him over the top in Michigan. Black voters in Milwaukee that took him over the top in Wisconsin. Black voters in Philadelphia. They're so frustrated. They saw that lead Trump seemed to have just dwindle and literally disappear over a couple of days, largely because of the Black voters in Philadelphia that came out in massive numbers to support it, as well as Black voters in Pittsburgh and, again, other parts of the state that don't get a lot of attention, right? And so this narrative, somehow we didn't come out enough for him, you know, that, oh, there was a decrease in Black support from, you know, 94 or whatever it was in 2016 down to 90. That's still larger than any other group. Like, you can't give the suburbs credit for helping Joe Biden win when at the end of the day, not only did Trump get a majority of white voters, he actually got a larger percentage of white women this time than he did in 2016. So for all this talk about the suburban mobs and how they're leaning Democrat and all that, he still got a majority of white voters in general and a larger percentage of white women than what he got in 2016. So we're dealing with that simultaneously. The local issues to us are just as important as those top of the ticket national issue. That's really where our sweet spot is. And so that's where a lot of the long-term power building has got to take place. The truth of the matter is even the situation that we're in nationally right now has not just been because of presidential elections. Republicans for decades have been better than Democrats and better than progressives at organizing at the local level and taking over local control of, you know, county commissions and state legislatures, and then once they get the state legislature, that's how they gerrymander, and gerrymandering, they're able to take control of congressional seats, and then all that bubbles up. So we didn't get into this situation that we're in overnight, and we didn't get into the situation we're in just because of the presidential. It's been a long-term strategy that the other folks, those who mean us harm, those who are anti-black, it's a long-term local-based strategy that they've engaged in. We've got to be just as effective at doing the reverse, having a very local, bottom-up, that's got to be the strategy. And so that's the work that we've got coming up. And part of that involves holding folks at all of those levels accountable. So that's from Joe Biden to these Senate seats that we went on down to city council. We believe that it's not just about putting in black faces, but we've got to rethink this entire political process. We've got to change it from a process where somebody comes to us telling us what their job is going to be, right? Where they write their own job description. They tell us what their agenda is going to be, and then we're forced to vote for them. That's a backwards process. We believe in flipping the process so that the people control the agenda, so that the people who are doing the hiring are the ones that are writing the job description, right? We believe in creating different structures like people's assemblies, like what they're using in Jackson, Mississippi, and some other places, that fundamentally changes our folks' relationship to power and to decision-making. That's the ultimate goal, not just to put black faces in high places, but to rethink and change and transform the entire way that we engage in this political process.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Stay strong and stay well.
Welcome to another episode of The Check-In. Short segments designed to answer common questions many of us just don't know the answers to. Our question today comes from JG, a member of the Local 271. JG asks, why don't we see our union reps on the job site more? I can't remember the last time I saw one come out to check on us. What's the point of paying for reps if we never see them? Well, thanks for your question, JG. To help us better understand where our union reps are, we'll ask Daniel Del Riel, union rep and president of the Local 146. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Hey, thanks for having me, Joe. I'm actually really excited to be here.
So, Daniel, the question today is, why don't we see reps more often on our job sites?
You know, Joe, when I saw that question, that was actually a really good question because I myself used to have that same question when I was an apprentice out in the field. It wasn't until I actually became a representative with the council that I realized how much representatives actually do outside of the standard work hours, you know, the 7 to 3:30. We always joke around and say, hey, you know what? A rep's time actually starts at 3:30 when everyone's getting off of work, driving home, and they start to make those phone calls. A lot of us have different responsibilities throughout the council, and a lot of us do have commitments outside of our standard 7 to 3:30 day. So just to kind of put that into perspective a bit more, I wanted to mention a couple of things. You know, ourselves as representatives, we don't only just visit union job sites. We also visit non-union job sites. And a lot of our representatives, the organizers that go and visit those non-union job sites, we do so to monitor things such as like the misclassification of workers, make sure that they're actually paying the workers the right money for the tasks that they're doing. They'll pull certified payroll. They go and talk to contractors as well as workers on job sites to either top down organize with the owners and let them know the benefits of joining the union, or we'll go and talk to the actual workers on the job site, the boots on the ground, and go let them know as well as the benefits of being union to try to get them to all band together and become part of our wonderful union. A lot of time and effort is actually spent on those organizing efforts. Myself, as well as a lot of other representatives, we sit on multiple JATCs. For those people looking for that acronym, that's the Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee. The whole purpose of those JATCs are to oversee the training of our apprentices to make sure they're actually following up with their training in accordance with the state, to put some actual physical numbers on it. This is crazy. Oregon and Southwest Washington, we have 21 representatives. And for those 21 representatives, we cover 111,000 square miles between Oregon and Southwest Washington. And to put the rest of the council in perspective, our entire six-state council, we cover 1.1 million square miles of area with around a UBC staff of around 90 people. So we stay pretty busy all over the council in all six states, making sure that we're doing as much as we can for our members. A lot of representatives, like I mentioned previously, we have responsibilities outside of our standard days. A lot of those responsibilities will be stuff like Sisters in the Brotherhood. Desi Wright does an amazing job getting a bunch of members actually excited about that. We have Dale Dvorak and Aaron Gray running the Veterans in the Brotherhood. Myself, Jeff Harms, Garth Finley, we handle the steward trainings across the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington. You have the ICRA outreach that a lot of us representatives are partaking in across all six states. So there's a lot of stuff going on out there. But the biggest issue here, too, is if you don't see a representative out on your job site, by all means, please pick up your phone, give us a call, give us a shoot us a text. We would be more than happy to go out there to go visit your job site and go address concerns that may be present. If you don't have a steward out on that job site, we'd be more than happy to assign a steward, too. You know, our stewards are our deputized representatives that will help out a rep when we can't make it out there day of or in a timely fashion. These are all things that we look for to make sure our members are taken care of. But we can only do that with effective communication between membership and the representatives, our instructors, so on and so forth. So we're always looking to help out. And if you haven't seen a rep, just let us know. We'd be more than happy to go have a chat.
Fantastic answer for a what I imagine is a fairly common question. It really does put it into perspective. And I appreciate you taking time from your obviously very busy schedule, Daniel, to be on the show. Thank you again for all you're doing out there.
Hey, thank you so much, Joe. I appreciate it, brother.
Our guest today was Daniel Del Real from the Northwest Carpenters Union. If you have a question that you would like to have answered on the check-in, send an email to gritnw@gmail.com. If your question gets answered on the check-in, you'll be entered to win an official I've Got Grit t-shirt in the monthly drawing. And if you haven't already done so, please take a moment to join Grit Nation by clicking on the hyperlink in the show notes. You'll be kept up to date on special offers and promotions only available to Grit Nation members. Till next time, this is Joe Cadwell reminding you to work safe, work smart, and stay union strong.
Welcome. This is the Brain Labor Report on November 18th, 2020. My name's Wes Brain. I'm host of the show.
Hi, and this is Jason Houck. I'm the engineer.
And pushing the buttons in the studio today, Jason. How's it going this morning?
It's going great. Everything is working fine.
I am glad to hear that. It doesn't happen every day. But big thanks to you for being there in the studio and helping us continue to do the Brain Labor Report. For folks who are maybe listening to this show for the first time, we've been doing it a long time. And the Brain Labor Report focuses on the issues that are so important for ordinary working people. To our guests right now, we're talking this morning, it's an honor to have Anthony Kurtz, Native American. Anthony Kurtz, a builder and contractor, lives here in Southern Oregon, and we're talking about the Alameda Fire and all the devastation, so many people wiped out. And Anthony's telling us about his business, and I'll let him take over and tell us the name of that business again, and tell us your views for how you see things moving forward and the work that you want to do. You got the microphone again, and a big thanks for joining us. Anthony.
Yeah, Wes, no problem. Definitely nice talking to you today, too, as well. Yeah, I've been working with the state and or getting ready to, anyways, talking with them about fire cleanup and stuff as well down there. And I'm hoping to hire locally here different contractors and people with bobcats, backhoes, dump trucks, all the stuff we need to clean the fires up, clean up the destruction anyways. So we're moving into that. There's so many fires out there that actually there are so many houses and complexes that got destroyed. It's going to take 2 to 3 years to clean all this stuff up, like I can imagine. But it will get rebuilt over time. It'll take some time for sure, but it'll look good when it's done. And you just got to hang in there and bide the time and so forth.
Yes, yes. Some of us are still wake up and shake our heads and can't believe that it's happened. And again, if you're outside the area, it's one of those things you just got to see. You've seen some of the photos, perhaps, and it's something you got to see firsthand. And it's quite devastating. And a lot of families are struggling with where to go. And what many people are hoping, Anthony, because a lot of the folks who lost their places, they lived in trailer parks or low-income housing between, you know, basically Ashland and over just North Phoenix is where the most of the devastation took place. A lot of these people were hardworking, ordinary people, working people, and there were also a number of elderly folks, and this has really hurt a segment of our community. These weren't millionaires who owned banks who lost their houses.
I heard as well that the small tracking houses like the mobile homes and stuff like that, they're going to keep those as well. And they're going to keep them into mobile homes. Because a lot of people aren't millionaires and can't afford to buy houses and all that stuff. So a good thing is, from what I hear, they're keeping the same areas, mobile homes. And so it'll go back the way it was.
Jason, are you still there? Are you listening to us?
Yeah, we're all here.
Jason, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. I know you have your fingers on the pulse of a lot of what's happened. My God, it's your own pulse. You were burned out of your house.
That's
you
right.
And your family were, Jason. And so I would like to bring you into the conversation. You hear what we're talking about. From you, Jason, any updates that you know of as we move forward? It changes a little bit from day to day. Any comments from you, Jason, as we continue the conversation with Anthony?
I can certainly speak on our experience as a resident of the Bear Creek Mobile Home Park, one of the first spaces that got burned in the Alameda fire. And yeah, there's around 70 families that are hoping to relocate or to come back into the park. I know the owner of the spaces is working so hard to make that happen, but it is going to take a while. I know there's just so much devastation out there. It's going to take a long time to make that, to recover that space. But yeah, I agree. It's our mobile home that is like some of the last affordable housing we have left in the Rogue Valley. And it's really tragic the way this fire seemed to really target the most vulnerable working class families and people. Yeah.
Well stated. Thank you for that. I want to thank Anthony Kurtz for coming on board today, telling us the challenges he's working on, and we want to wish you good luck with it.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this episode of CTU Speaks Strike Anniversary.
Homie, I was taught by Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher, so I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago teachers.
I am your co-host, Andrea Parker, and I am joined with my co-host,
Jim Staros. How's it going there, Miss Parker?
It is going well.
I'm glad.
Yes, I am so excited that this is the anniversary of our infamous strike.
I know. It's crazy, right? I mean, it's hard to believe it's already been a whole year.
I know, time goes by so fast, but I am so glad that we, as a union of 25,000 strong, made the decision to go on strike for the equity of our students.
That's right. And don't forget, we were joined with SEIU and also with the Park District as well. That was a giant strike downtown. And we're about to hear some of those voices from the strike back a year ago. It's going to be fun. We're going to hear some of the stuff that was going on the strike line.
We had politicians, we had parents, we had students, we had a lot of retirees, people from all over the country support us because they understood our efforts. They knew that our efforts were not selfish. They knew that our efforts were student-centered. They knew that equity was needed for all students across CPS, where you do not have this system of the have and have nots.
And we've got some voices from a year ago, Ms. Parker, that we're going to revisit. They were on our episode 5. You can scroll back about 30 episodes now. You've done a lot of episodes in this last year.
And it's very easy to scroll. I did it myself. It's an easy scroll.
Even Miss Parker can scroll. Come on, you can do it. But we're going to hear from a bunch of different people during the strike. And And remember, this is before the strike. So these are people talking about, we asked them a question, why are you willing to strike? And this is what they said they were willing to do. And I want you, as they're talking, think about all the stuff we actually won. We didn't know we were going to win this stuff at the time, but this is what people were saying they wanted, what they need to be successful within the classroom, and what we need to do to move forward. Let's listen.
My name is Marco Camacho. I teach at Whittier Elementary. I'm a special education teacher. The reason why we're marching is for our students. We need more social workers. We need more support. We need nurses, because we work in at-risk neighborhoods where our students experience a great deal of trauma, and we don't have the resources that we need to help our young people.
My name is Carolyn Brown. I'm a teacher at Kelly High School, and I'm marching because my students and my colleagues deserve better than we have right now, and we want the city to see us and what we're willing to do to get what our schools deserve.
My name is Anna. I go to Kilmer. I'm in fifth grade. And why I'm here is because my classroom size is too big, and I got 32 kids in my class, and it should be 22.
So I'm Jeffrey Howard, Executive Vice President of SEIU Local 73, and I'm here to support the workers of the Chicago Teachers Union, SEIU Local 73, our 7,000 members at the Chicago Public Schools, and our 3,000 members at the Chicago Park District. We take care of the most vulnerable people in this city, our children, many of our adults. We keep our schools safe, clean. We keep our parks open and available to all the citizens of Chicago. I'm here to support these workers today in their contract fight, and we're asking the mayor, take care of these workers that take care of the city of Chicago. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sarah Saig. I'm a retired CPS librarian. I worked at DuSable, which was a school that had a librarian continuously from 1935 until when I had to retire in 2017 because CPS cut my position four times. I don't understand why our children in Chicago can't have their basic needs met in their public schools.
My name is Evelyn A. Davis West, and I'm a CPS seeker, and the reason why I'm here standing for all is for fairness and justice and for a fair contract. Lori Lightfoot, get on the right foot. Fair contract now.
Everywhere we go!
Well, thank you, everybody, for listening to CTU Speaks and celebrating our one-year anniversary of the strike with us. There'll be more victories to come and more celebrations to come with the Chicago Teachers Union. And again, thank you for listening to us.
And don't forget, we are CTU Speaks, where we only speak what matters.
Okay, Jill, I was ready to say it, but you beat me to the punch. I like that. We do.
I snatched it, yeah.
I love it. We are a team. That's what we do, right?
That's how we play. That's how we roll here.
All right, our faithful new listeners, we will see you at the next episode.
Bye.
Speak up. Speak out. Get involved. Get involved.
Engage-toi.
Take action.
Aktiviere deine Stimme.
We're union and we're proud.
Welcome to Activate Live. This is a special edition. I'm Tanya Hutchins with the Machinist Union. We have a preview for you of a new movie that shows the importance of organizing and standing up for your rights. It's called Stand and is set during the Winnipeg General Strike of 1919. More than 100 years later, that strike makes it to the big screen, and you can be a part of the U.S. premiere on December 1st. Joining us now is producer, writer, and composer Danny Shore. Danny, first tell us, how did this movie come about?
Well, way back when, in 2003, I was going to be writing my third musical. What was then a really obscure event where I am, I'm in Winnipeg, Canada, the 1919 Winnipeg General Strike. I knew it was dramatic, and you'd be the subject of, or a good subject for, a stage musical. Wrote it, knew nothing like I know now about labor history, had no idea until I got into the research just how much it may as well be ripped from today's headlines. And at that first run, none other than Jeff Goldblum was sitting beside me, because he was in a relationship with the lead female actress of the stage show. And he said, big story, big ideas, it would make a great movie. And I thought, wow, if Jeff Goldblum thinks it'll make a great movie, I should act on it. And who knew, it took like 14 or 15 years, but we got it to stage, got it to the screen.
Now, there have only been a few movies with labor themes since Norma Rae had mainstream success in 1979. I remember watching that movie. What was it like working with a union theme in 2020?
Well, in some ways, it was a breath of fresh air, because we garnered the support of the whole union movement all across North America, including IAM. In some ways, because it is a musical, it was the weirdest thing ever. There was so many of our conversations in the offices of some of the national affiliates where the look was, we'll let these guys in the office. But everyone got the idea. We were trying to make the new Norma Rae, but married with the kind of hipness that Hamilton has. And we said we were making this movie for the next generation of activists, both to remind people of history, but also to show how what's going on right now is so similar to the past. So you can learn from the past and take it forward.
If we all hold as one, they haven't a hope. We'll starve them back to work. We will protect this city from the criminals behind this strike. Immigrants, foreigners, Bolsheviks. The alien enemy we just fought a war against.
Is that true?
Would you rather have the public on our side?
Of course I would.
Then of course it's true. And that's what's going in the newspaper.
The paper's on strike, in case you didn't notice.
Even better, we get to publish our own. From now on, everything I say is true. I am the public face of the Citizens Committee. You back me up on every word I say, every decision I make, and I will have every worker begging to come back at the same wage they walked out on, or less.
We're gonna need the feds behind us on this.
Leave it to me. All of it.
How long will it take?
As long as necessary. I give them a week.
Now, we have another clip, and this is the musical scene, a singing scene, where the maids are walking out. Can you set that up a little bit?
So imagine, in 1919, people are starving all across the world, and these non-unionized maids, who are black and who have just a tremendous amount to lose by joining this general strike that's enveloping the whole city. They get the guts to do this. And in this song, the very great Lisa Bell, our breakout star from Winnipeg, Canada, who's just like a Whitney Houston in vocal potential, sings this song. And I tell you, every time I hear it, it just gives me chills and the hair goes up on my arms hearing Lisa sing this song, because you can just imagine the stakes are so high, and yet they decide to make a stand.
All right, here it is.
I lend the hand I deserve. So now my life.
have drawn my line in the sand, and this is where I stand.
How can union locals and state federations or labor councils participate in that December 1st premiere if they'd like to see it as a group?
Well, we certainly recognize that we could not have had a worse time. The COVID numbers are not great. So we're not actively saying go in big groups, but the theaters are open in certain jurisdictions. They're subject to very restricted seating. So for those for whom it's safe to do so, you can gather in a very socially distanced, deep cleaned, mask wearing theater and be, you know, 20 people in a theater that would normally sit 300. This movie is really well enjoyed on the big screen. So all people need to do is follow the website, and you can buy individual tickets via the website, search the theater near you that's playing. It's playing in some 400 theaters across the land.
Well, thank you so much for the inside scoop.
Oh, you bet. Thanks.
That was Danny Scher, producer, writer, and composer of Stand. Now, the premiere is Tuesday, December 1st in almost every state. For more information about group tickets or individual tickets, you can visit the website stand-movie.com. That's stand-movie.com. You can even suggest the event to your local lodge president or state federation. That's all we have for this special edition of Activate Live. Keep checking your email for iMail updates on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Stay healthy and stay safe.
The San Francisco Mime Troupe presents Tales of the Resistance, four series of original political comedy audio plays presented as podcasts and audio shows on stations across the country by the never ever silent, always radical, and confusingly named San Francisco Mime Troupe. We have presented Jade for Hire, Novice Nurse Susie Terse, Fear of the Dark, and Dimension 2020. And now, part two of the final episode, The End of the Beginning.
City newspaper?
It's a start.
But I didn't give you permission to give City newspaper a copy of Clia.
Hello.
You still don't see her true potential.
But you can't take her. She's mine.
Every phone, every computer, every tablet, every choice made for them, and what they really want delivered on their doorstep, in every newspaper, on every website, and in every ballot box.
The election.
Exactly.
Clia.
Hello.
Plan A, make people fear in-person voting, to distrust mail-in ballots, then at the last minute...
At the last minute, tell everyone about me, an amazing new app that will vote for who and what they really want from the privacy of their own pocket.
But people are more than what they buy or blog or post on Facebook.
I'm sorry to interrupt this broadcast, but I have a special announcement. A few minutes ago, the President of the United States released this statement... Due to the ongoing violent unrest of left-wing agitators and Antifa revolutionaries, widespread voter fraud, and the difficulty in securing in-person polling places during this latest surge in COVID-19, I, Donald J. Trump, am announcing the postponement of all federal and local elections for the year 2020. Wait, what? He can't do that. The president can't. Oh. This order does not come from the White House, but from the state legislatures, the majority of which are controlled by patriotic members of the Republican Party who will not ratify any electoral votes under these circumstances. Elections will be rescheduled for whenever they and I feel they can be safely and securely held. Until then, I, Donald J. Trump, shall remain your president. God bless America. Wait, we're getting another announcement. The president has just declared martial law Attorney General Barr has stated that anyone not complying with an immediate stay-at-home order will be considered in a state of insurrection and treated as such. News agencies across the country are being taken off the air, and we're getting reports that some have been forced to not report on the president's order until martial law is in place. Ladies and gentlemen, friends, I don't know what to say. I don't even know if you're still listening. Someone's beating on the door to the station. I can hear yelling downstairs. I don't know what's going on. I think they've gotten in the building. Footsteps running up the stairs. They're outside the studio. The door, they're breaking in the door.
Get that microphone.
Who are you?
Her name's Amanda.
That means power.
Is this thing on?
You're on the air.
Comrades, can you hear me? People are in the streets, marching on city halls and capitals around the country, demanding that our elected employees do their job and defend the Constitution they swore to uphold.
We're getting reports from across the country. New York, Detroit, Atlanta, Denver, Oakland.
Everywhere. People are not just standing up. They are taking back our country from a would-be dictator and his henchmen.
And henchwomen.
You gotta tell everybody. On Facebook, Instagram, Twitter.
We're getting a report from downtown. People have surrounded City Hall.
We're getting phone calls from all over.
How do I put them on the air?
I'll do it.
Hello? Are you there?
This is Nurse Susie Terse, me and my friend Sparks.
We appropriated Ambulance 57.
And we're ready to help any protesters who get injured defending our democracy.
Thanks, Susie.
I've got another one on line two.
This is Primo Bacal.
Primo!
I'm an ex-cop, and I'm out here teaching self-defense and tactics to anyone willing to fight the fascists.
Good for you.
We're getting a call for someone named Derek.
Derek?
Derek.
Derek?
Greg.
Derek!
What are you doing?
I got a story about Plan A, Plan B, Plan C, and chlamydia!
Chlamydia?
I mean Claya!
We're getting word, something is happening at the protest at City Hall.
What's going on?
We've got a live feed.
And we cannot allow this canceling of our democracy. This is our country, not theirs, not his. We, the working people, built it, brick by brick, house by house, every road and factory. And now they think they can take it away from us. Are we gonna let them?
No!
The only reason they think they are better than us is because we let them get rich from our labor. Because they own what we made. Because they convinced us that they want the same things we do. But they don't. Because all we want is what we made and earned. Our country.
Yeah!
The time for us to ask for a place at a table we built is over. The time for us to hope they will give us justice has passed. And if this president thinks he has the power to take our country from us, it is time for us to show him what real power is.
Yeah!
And we're just getting started. This ain't the beginning of the end. It's the end of the beginning. Amandla!
That means power.
You can read the judgment of history or write your own part in the tale. March on Selma, riot at Stonewall, or watch as your friends go to jail. Rise up for Black Lives, attack with Antifa, waiting on progress has failed. The battle must be won, so join us in the sun.
Slapstick is our weapon of choice. We
always draw a crowd. We're red and hot and proud. Silent no, hell aloud. The San Francisco Mime Troupe. A collective with a socialist objective. We put things in perspective with 60 years of free shows in the parks. Sci-fi to detective, satire to invective, tragedy and farce.
And farce.
We fought the man with every show.
Took a shot at old Jim Crow.
And made the hippie heads go pop
with Madcap at Jim Crow.
The bourgeois made a scene.
Claimed we were obscene.
And had us hauled up by the cops.
Now that was two shows before that.
This is ahistorical.
We're revolutionaries raising our voice. Subversive verse is our weapon of choice. We always draw a crowd. We're red and hot and proud. Silent no, hell aloud. The San Francisco Mime Troupe. A tradition.
July 4th in the Mission. Actors and musicians build our stage and leave without a trace.
With words for ammunition, we serve politicians.
Egg on their face.
Hopey,
changey, droney. We're not scared to call out phonies. And we even got a Tony. Isn't it sublime?
A new play every year. A treat for eyes and ears.
Cause we're not that kind of mind. No, we're not that kind of mind.
Favorite show?
Well, heck if I know.
Maybe Freedom Land.
Or something with back wino.
Eating it or 1600 Transylvania Ave.
I like the red state and possibilidad. Steel Town was built to last.
Treasure Island's a treasure.
I saw seeing double twice and twice more motion measure.
And the costumes. Dragon Lady, Armageddon Man. The incredible transforming sets. The puppetry, the band. We're revolutionaries raising our voice. Serious comedy, our weapon of choice. We always draw a crowd.
We hope you have enjoyed and were inspired by the San Francisco Mime Troupe's radio and podcast debut. And this coming December, we will be returning with the radio premiere of A Red Carol, our labor-oriented adaptation of Dickens's classic, A Christmas Carol. Before we go, we'd just like to thank all those who donated to support Tales of the Resistance. The troupe doesn't take corporate sponsorship, so we could not have done this or any of our free shows without your financial support. And if you want to show more support, our website is www.sfmt.org. Thank you to the San Francisco Arts Commission, SF Grants for the Arts, California Arts Council, USPPP, the Flyshacker Foundation, the Bernard Osher Foundation, the Zellerbach Family Foundation, Brewster Kahle and Mary Austin, the Don Stevens and Nicole Bellotti Laugh and Love Fund, this public radio station, and listeners like you. Thank you for listening to Tales of the Resistance. We'll see you this Christmas. Power to the people.
That's going to do it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast, weekly hour roundup of highlights from nearly 80 labor radio shows and podcasts. I really hope you enjoyed our selections this week. I know I did. The Labor Radio Podcast Network shows focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, and you can also find them by using the hashtag Labor Radio Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Evan Papp and Patrick Dixon, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net. Find out more on our website, laborradionetwork.org. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active, and of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio podcast show.